On dozens of music charts in both the U.S. and around the world, the song A Lullaby by Sean Mullins was a top 10 song, if not a number one hit, back in 1998. And Sean Mullins continues to make music today as well, with a new album called Light You Up, released less than 1 year ago. And he joins us right now via Skype and makes a connection on Round Trip with Dave-O. Welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Dave-O, how you doing?
Pretty good. I really want to ask you more about your new album, and from what I gather, you've undergone kind of like a complete transformation. Like, even your diehard fans have been surprised from what I gather with this. How would you describe the sound of the new record?
Well, I don't know. I think it was recorded mostly live, so all the instruments were recorded together. So it's definitely done in a very old-school way. And, you know, records just aren't really made that way hardly anymore. So it's a different way of doing it, and, you know, it produces a different sound. I don't know that my songwriting's all that different, although I co-wrote a lot of these songs with a couple of really great writers, one by the name of Chuck Cannon. And Max Gomez was another guy that I wrote a lot with. But I don't know that my sound's really that different, but I think the record has a different sound about it, and I hope people will check it out. See what they think.
Now, this kind of intrigues me. I read somewhere on your website that it says it was recorded and created at your quote-unquote rustic Georgia cabin. So what's that cabin like? Is that like a place you go quite a bit to make music? Or?
Yeah, it's a writing studio cabin, and we decided that, hey, why not drag all you know, a whole recording studio in here and let's make a record? Because I always liked the way it sounded in there. So, It was cool, you know. We set the drums up in the dining area, and it didn't have a lot of furniture anyway, so we just filled the whole thing full of equipment and made a record in a few weeks. It was really fun.
Now, besides that new album, you also became a father recently, with Murphy, born back in August of 2009. What's it like being a dad, and how has that changed you?
Oh man, I love it. I love it. There's nothing like it. Totally in love like I've never been before. And you know, the main thing that changes is how much I want to be gone, you know. I tour a lot. And so I'm looking at that and trying to figure out, hey, maybe it's time I cut back so that I don't miss out on him and he doesn't miss out on me. And he'll be two in August. So it's been a blast. I love it.
Now, you're originally from Atlanta, and you were friends with a couple of the Indigo Girls back in the day, you know, in high school, especially Amy Ray. So how did you meet her? I've always kind of wondered that. And then what role has she and they played in your career?
Well, yeah, it's funny. You know, I was in the ninth grade, and I was taking an elective called career education, which is like, you know, some BS elective that basically you're trying to get out of something else.
Right.
You're taking career education. But every week they would have somebody come in and talk about what they did for a living. And Amy had just started with Emily, with Indigo Girls, and she was still at Emory University. But she came in and talked about being a singer-songwriter and a musician. And you know, it just kind of gave me hope that, hey, there are people out there doing this that are doing their own thing and doing it independently. And so, yeah, she was a big influence on me and somewhat of a mentor over the years. They both have been really great. Done a lot of shows with them over the years. So, yeah, that was definitely kind of my final way of knowing I wanted to do acoustic music was getting to know them. And you know, how cool is that to be able to pull off a show with just an acoustic guitar and really entertain people?
Well, yeah, and so that was ninth grade. So you knew even in ninth grade that how far before that did you know you wanted to do music? Was that kind of a thing since childhood, or when did that interest start?
Yeah, I always wanted to do it. I always knew I was going to do music. I just didn't know exactly what avenue to take because I love so many types of music, and I think that's why every record I do is slightly different than the one before it, because I don't really, I'm not, you know, unfortunately, I don't have one type of thing that I enjoy doing. And I, you know, that probably has kept me off of pop charts since 99 because I didn't keep doing the same thing. You know, it was harder for people to remember you, you know, but that's not as important to me. You know, I think the biggest thing for me is to try to keep creating the music I believe in and I want to do. And, you know, I'm very fortunate and very lucky to be able to do it for a living.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong about this. So kind of some biographical stuff here. Some of it came from Wikipedia, so, you know, 50-50 chance it's accurate.
Yeah, yeah, you're right about that.
Okay, so after high school, from what I understand, you went to college at North Georgia College and State University, with the original goal of pursuing a military career, you know, possibly. And then, while you were there, you were bandmaster of the military marching band for a short while, but then soon after said, you know what, I'm going to focus more on my solo career and recording. So I'm assuming the solo career scored you a lot more chicks than the band director days. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's actually really true. But, you know, I did all of that. That's all true. And also I started a band, you know, in college, and we were doing a lot of covers, a lot of, you know, 80s college rock covers. And I started sneaking my own songs into the set, and they went over really well. And I just kind of eventually became original from that, you know, and a lot of the same crowd would still come to see me. So that was kind of how I got my start, you know, and, played in Atlanta a lot in the same kind of, small bars that a lot of the local bands here in Atlanta have come out of, you know, but yeah, no, totally. It was a great experience. And I actually was going to military college, and I did spend a little bit of time in the Army afterwards. And you know, the Army had helped me pay for college, and so I owed them a little time. So, you know, I became a second lieutenant in the infantry and did a little bit of that. And, you know, fortunately never had to go to combat. But trained a lot and then got out and started hitting the road.
Now, you mentioned some of the bars there a second ago, and we're talking to Sean Mullins right now on Roundtrip with Devo, but some of the bars you played. So I read a story once about Trackside Tavern in Decatur, which
yeah.
I you know, heard was quite the rough bar back in the day. So did you really play during some fights and stuff, you know, a long time ago?
Oh, yeah. You know, not as many fights at Trackside. Trackside was a pretty peaceful little bar. But there was a place up in Dahlonega where I went to college called Bose. And Bose was pretty rough. Bose was definitely the kind of place that, you know, you wish there was chicken wire around the stage, but there wasn't. You know, it was that kind of thing. But you better learn Stand By Your Man and all that like the Blues Brothers did. But, no, Trackside was a great room for a singer-songwriter. It was, people came there to listen, and it was, you know, very odd if anything happened violent in there. It was a pretty peaceful place.
So back in the day, I tried to find your first album. It was only on cassette, Ever Changing World, back in 1991. I think it's impossible, though, to find. But is there any chance that stuff will ever get re-released? And is that album bearable for you to listen to? Because I know, like, when you're an artist, you look back at your early stuff and you're like, man, that was awful. Is that how it is for you, or do you still like
it? Yeah. Yeah, you know, and there's one actually before that, too, from 1990 that it's cassette only as well. You know, it wasn't until about 94 that I started to feel like I knew what I was writing about. You know, I think some people, they're able to do it earlier. I think I matured a little later as a songwriter. You know, I didn't get that, you know, it's really all about the song. And it was just dying to get into the studio and record. And it's not bad for a 19-year-old. It's pretty good. But, you know, I was no Prince at 19 either, you know. So I think I had to learn. You know, I studied a lot of great musicians, a lot of great songwriters, and I think around 1994 it started to kind of, you know, started to get somewhere, and I started to really kind of move up as a performer and a writer, and then in 98 all that blew up with Lullaby. So
yeah, we'll talk about that here in 1 second, but one more question about that 92 to 96 era. So you said 94 is kind of where you hit your stride. So, you know, it seemed like you had like an album like every 6 months during that time. From like, you know, that era, what are your favorite albums or songs from that 94 to 96 era?
You know, I loved the kind of back end of the grunge stuff. I loved, you know, obviously loved Nirvana, and I know that's a little earlier, but I loved a lot of rock that was coming out of Atlanta. I'm friends with Ed Roland from Collective Soul, so I loved seeing his success and how that went down. And, you know, I just love a lot of music, man. I mean, I love, you know, any of the kind of, you know, Sister Hazel are friends of mine, so those guys had a lot going on kind of in that mid-90s, and Edwin McCain was right around a little bit after that, and you know, it's been fun to watch all these guys that I played clubs with, you know, and Hootie and the Blowfish are friends of mine. I did a whole tour with them back in 99, and so, yeah, I mean, a lot of that stuff that was from the South, you know, Matchbox 20, Rob Thomas was a great, great guy, and, you know, came to see me early on, and so that, you know, those kind of bands, but I like everything. I mean, I love early Spearhead. I love Michael Franti's early work from the 90s. And, you know, I love good hip hop and rap, and I love good jazz. And I like a little bit of everything.
Now, the story of All in My Head, I know you wrote that specifically for Scrubs. Now, again, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but from how I understand it, you wrote it, sent it off in like less than 24 hours after you heard Scrubs looking for a theme song, and then you randomly heard it on the TV show without expecting to hear it. Is that all true?
Yeah, that is. They didn't use it for their theme song, obviously, but they stuck it in the kind of end of one of the episodes. And my manager had cleared it because he knew I would want to do it, but he forgot to tell me. And which is really funny. So I'm watching, you know, Scrubs, and all of a sudden I hear something familiar in the background. And it was one of those songs that's not really featured, the whole song, as much part of the song, you know, at the end of the episode. But I was like, wait a minute, that's a terrible demo I sent in.
He forgot to tell you? How did that work?
Yeah, you know, your manager a lot of times is that they know that you're into trying to, he knew I was trying to get onto the TV show, so he basically, you know, cleared it and then forgot to call me about it.
That's funny. Okay, so then before we talk about 98 and the insane success you had with Lullaby, obviously, I want to know kind of the story. How did you end up with Sony and Columbia? Was that kind of a, you know, do you remember the actual moment that happened? And was that kind of a surprise, or were you expecting that, or how'd that work?
Well, it really happened because the song broke at alternative radio station 99X here in Atlanta. Leslie Pham, who was the program director there, you know, started spinning the song in heavy rotation and just started building with other stations, you know, and she really championed the project, as she did a lot of people in the 90s from 99X. You know, people that ended up going on to pop radio, a lot of it got kick-started there at those types of stations. So that's really how it started. But, you know, basically I didn't have a label. I was doing my own stuff. And when that blew up, I sold out of all the CDs I had pretty much in just a couple of weeks locally. And so I needed a label for the first time to just get records printed, you know, and I didn't have money to put behind anything like this. Luckily, there was almost all the major labels and a bunch of the independent labels started courting me immediately when they kind of heard this runaway hit. And so, you know, I was really lucky. I had my choice of record companies, and I ended up with Columbia. I thought they were a great, great label, but there was a big bidding war for the project. And it was one of those, you know, I got signed kind of at the height of the record industry in the 90s, you know, and so it was still kind of happening, and big, huge deals were still floating around back then. So I got really lucky, and the song ended up going to number one in January of 99. So it was I think the first number one of that year.
So that song Lullaby, what do you remember about the day or night or moment you wrote that? You know, was that something you'd had in your mind for a while? How long did it take you to write it? Where were you at? You know, et cetera.
I was in LA and playing this little place called Genghis Cohen, and a woman about my age came up and just told me her story, you know, of growing up in the Hollywood Hills back in the 70s and some of the 80s. And it just really blew my mind. And I journal a lot. So when I got back that night, I started journaling. And the first line of the journal was, "She grew up with the children of the stars." And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then I just started rhyming. And so the song lyrically really wrote itself, you know, in a half an hour. And then I kind of worked on the melody of the chorus over the next day or so, but it was pretty quick.
Did you know right away that it was going to be the one? I mean, did you have an idea?
Well, as it was coming out, I decided, you know, if this doesn't do it, it's just not going to happen for me, because this thing, there's something special about this one. It was really fun. You know, every now and again, one happens like that, and it's really a interesting thing. You know, you always hear people say that it feels like it's a gift, but it really does feel that way. You know, you work hard at it, but it also feels like all the stars align for you for a moment.
Yeah, and I made my first trip to Hollywood, actually, about a month ago. So I wanted you to know, I stayed at the Renaissance there on Hollywood Boulevard, and that song kept going through my head the whole time. So thanks for, you know, having that stuck in my head for 2 days.
Sorry, man.
So that was nominated for a Grammy. Did you actually get to go to the award show for the Grammys?
I did, yeah. I did. My family went with me. It was really fun. You know, I knew I didn't have much of a chance against Eric Clapton, but I think I had a pretty good chance. But he just, you know, he had a great song that year. I think it was My Father's Eyes was the one that won for best male vocal performance. But man, what an honor, you know, just to be out there in that category, and it was truly an honor.
Now, you played at the American Music Awards, I know, also in 1999. What do you remember about the American Music Awards night?
Yeah, that one's like kind of like a blurry dream because there were so many people that I met that night. Everybody from Gene Simmons in full makeup to, you know, Donnie and Marie to Garth Brooks to just all these people, one after another, you know, coming up and going, man, I love your song, you know, kind of flipping me out. So it was really like kind of some bizarre dream from my childhood, you know, especially the people that came up and were so kind to me, like Gene Simmons, you know. In fact, I actually ran into the back of him backstage. It was dark. And I run into this thing. I immediately smell leather, you know. And this big monster-looking guy turns around, and it's Gene in his full garb with his dragon boots on. It was pretty cool.
That's great.
He was like, you did good out there, kid, because I just sung the song, you know. So he was like, you did real good, man, you know.
That's awesome. So
yeah.
I think you're the most lucky guy in the world, not because you had number one hit, but because you got to hang out with Dominique Swain. I've always had a big crush on her. She was in the video for Lullaby, obviously. Now, what was
how'd
you hooked up with that? Did you know her or something? Or
No, the director just, you know, when we were putting it together, they saw several, you know, people, and the director was like, no, I really think Dominique Swain's the right person for it. And I said, do you really think we can get her? And he's like, yeah, absolutely. So they ended up making the call, and she was kind of between work and did it. And she was really cool. I mean, she was young. I mean, I was 29, and she seemed like such a kid to me. You know, she was like 19 or something and had her pet ferret with her the whole day, you know. But she was really good. She was really, really good.
Yeah. Now, back in those days, you opened up for like In Vogue, BSB, Destiny's Child. What's your favorite concert memory in particular from the, you know, kind of from that Lullaby era?
Well, you know, I did do a lot of the pop, you know, I did a lot of opening for boy bands and for, you know, all kinds of people. But I really enjoyed the Hootie and the Blowfish tour because we had such a good time jamming after the shows and you know, those guys were just some of the nicest guys, and they still are. And that was really the thing that I kind of enjoyed because it was a whole summer. And, you know, we must have done 35 or 40 shows during the summer and just had a blast. But I loved all of it, man. I mean, I thought some of it was kind of strange billing because that was me and acoustic guitar opening for a boy band. You know, sometimes it was a little weird, but that's also kind of cool, you know. To break it up a little bit and have a well-rounded show, I guess.
Now, the song Shimmer was in Dawson's Creek. I think it was like the Australian theme for the Olympics in 2000 or something, too?
Yeah, it sure was.
What's that song about? How'd you come up with that one?
Well, you know, that one was written a few years before that. It was written in 95, and it was really inspired by a visit to the hospital. I was visiting a friend that had been shot, actually, in a robbery, and he was trying to help someone who was being mugged and was shot. So I was visiting my buddy, and I walked through the maternity ward part where you can kind of look through the glass there and see the new babies. And, you know, it just inspired the first part of that song, and then the song just continued to write. And, you know, my wife now, she was my girlfriend at the time, Kelly, you know, really inspired that song as well. You know, just somebody with a, you know, cup half full, very positive outlook on life. And I tend to be the brooding artist sometimes and can kind of go the other way. So it's always nice to surround myself with positive people.
Right. Now, you continue, like we talked about earlier. You've got the new album out. You're also on a lot of other projects. I know you did a big part of Zac Brown Band's song Toes. How fun was it to work with them?
Oh, it was a blast. And I've known Zac since he was a kid. You know, he was 14 when I met him. And it's just so great to see that success happen for such a great guy. I've been writing a lot kind of for in the country realm and just whatever, you know. I love writing songs, so to me it doesn't really matter what the style is. It all comes down to a lyric and a melody, and it's just been really a blast watching good things to happen to good people like that. You know, that's really one of the best people I know, and really takes care of his crew and his everyone that works with him and his fans as well.
So the future of Sean Mullins, we know you've got the kid now. We know you at some point probably want to tour a little bit less, maybe. You know, what do you see? Are you going to be alive for music? What, you know, what's the future?
Well, yeah, I'm really qualified for anything else. So this is probably what I do. You know, I'm writing more. So, I mean, I think part of it as I get older, to still tour, but touring less. You know, I tour a lot of theaters and clubs still and really enjoy that small, intimate audience. But it's grueling. You know, you get out there and you're not with your family. And so I think part of the future holds me writing for other people more, which is what I've really enjoyed doing in the last couple of years. So, you know, I had a pretty good shot for the new CeeLo record, but I didn't quite make the cut with the song I threw in there. And that's part of the deal. You know, you throw in every 10 you write for someone, one might work, you know. And so, but I'm in the game of doing that, which is really a blast.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. Now, the best way for the fans to keep up with you, you have a website. Tell us about that and how we can keep up with you also.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just SeanMullins.com, and we're on Facebook, of course. And, you know, I always have tour scheduling and, you know, journaling, and sometimes we'll have some fun little videos from the road up there. And, no, I really appreciate it, and I just love doing it and look forward to doing it more.
Thank you so much for all your time. You know, it's been an honor following you since back in the day and playing your music, and we look forward to the next chapter of your career.
Hey, thanks, Davos.